Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Security Magazine GeoCyber video podcast with myself, Ian Thornton Trump, CISO for Sajax, and Philip Engram, MBE, and CEO of Grey Hair Media. Welcome, Philip.
Good to be here, Ian. Good to see you again.
Thank you very much. I would think that right now, of course, anything we talk about will always be in reference to what's going on in the Ukraine and Russia. But I wanted to actually focus in on the Middle East and the opportunities and challenges that rely in that particular part of the world, which, of course, you know, we've lost focus on. I think the thing that really struck me is when the mainstream media and the InfoSec media have been proclaiming that what is going on in the Ukraine from a physical war and a cyber war is unprecedented. And I wanted to destroy that myth, and I'm hoping that you kind of see it in the same light, that if we want to see what's going on in the Ukraine and the Russian conflict at hyperspeed, we only need to look back at what has transpired between the various players in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Why don't you walk me through, you know, some of the big regional issues that the Middle East is facing and how that looks a lot like the Russian-Ukraine conflict.
Sorry, is there something going on in Russia and Ukraine? I've clearly missed it. No, I get it completely. And you know, the pretext of this is that everyone was expecting, and I was expecting, you know, before the Russians invaded, that there would be massive cyber attacks and cyber outages that would have affected us across the globe as a precursor, and then something that the Russians would have followed up on. The press has been saying that. The wider cyber industry has been saying that that's going to happen.
Vendors have been trying to sell us that.
Well, it's in the vendor's interest to make sure that, you know, everyone sees this big threat, this big bad beast coming across. Yeah. But I think it's fascinating that it hasn't been at the level that we've expected.
No.
And there's a number of reasons for that. And this will then translate into what's happened in the Middle East as well, I think. You know, I think the principal reason for it is that there isn't that cyber weapon that can be controlled.
Yeah.
You know, you look at NotPetya that in 2017 was targeted at Ukrainian industry through a bit of Ukrainian accounting software.
That's right.
As a part of a cyber weapon that the Russians wanted to use to try and close down Ukrainian businesses. It sort of did that, but then broke
it
out.
Escaped.
It escaped into the wild.
Yeah.
And a large number of the computers that got effectively bricked by it were Russian MOD computers. They hurt themselves.
Yeah.
And therefore, there's the lack of control there. And that will have concerned the Russians in what they're doing. If they can't control what's happening to it, they might hurt themselves more than they hurt the target. And that has probably influenced them not to go down that cyber weapon route. Now, the same thing has happened before in the Middle East. You look at that very sophisticated nation-state attack by the analysis of the attack vector with Stuxnet.
That's
into
right.
the Iranian centrifuges for their nuclear program. And that was designed as a SCADA device that wasn't connected to the internet. It was air-gapped away, yet the backbone of the malware that was put in there has been taken out, understood, used, and fired back out again, and put back out into the wild in slightly other guises. And you bricked all the computers of Saudi Aramco, has been used to hit critical national infrastructure in the United States, target in the UK and across Europe, and other places across the Middle East. So there's that lack of control of it. And then we get into you know, the US cyber exploitation tools, the Eternal Blue hits.
And Double Pulsar,
and you know, with Eternal Blue and all the derivatives that come out of that, once that got picked up and different nations are starting to use it, then it's back out in the wild again. So there's that lack of control. And I think that lack of control started and became most obvious in the Middle East, first of all.
Yeah, and I know that the Ukrainian conflict has really been characterized as, you know, a sovereign state being invaded by Russia. Obviously, the Ukraine, if you're a student of history like both of us are, Ukraine has been occupied on Russia. The Ukraine has been occupied by a number of different powers over the course of its existence. this seems to line up a lot with the Middle East and sort of at the end of Yalta, the arbitrary boundaries that were put in place to create, you know, the kingdoms that we're faced with today. And so you characterized it as there is a Shia civil war between the Sunnis and the Shias within the Middle East with sort of Israel and some other non-aligned countries. And I think this is a very interesting backdrop, I think, you know, to where the Ukraine and Russia are struggling in terms of like, no, we're sovereign, and Russia's view is, no, you're not. You are a part of our Soviet empire. You will now be a part of it, whether you like it or not. Do you see that rivalry between Shia and Sunni again sort of like turning into two battling caliphates?
Well, effectively, I think we've got two battling caliphates at the moment. You know, if you look at where the majority of the Middle East countries, as they're bounded today on maps and bits and pieces, were designed, it was in London and Paris with civil servants, with rulers on maps who went, that's a big bit of desert, rip, and drew lines down maps and other bits and pieces and created these countries and destroyed the ancient lands of Persia and the ancient lands of Palestine and everything else. They didn't take into account any of the tribal boundaries, any of the family boundaries, any of the cultural boundaries that were around the place, any of the religious boundaries that were there. And therefore we've got these countries that are sort of artificial in the way that they were created because of the boundaries and everything else, not reflecting a lot of the priorities that there are on the ground. And effectively, the priorities through the Middle East, the priorities through a lot of the Muslim world has been this differential between Sunni and Shia aspects of the Muslim faith, and those two elements quite clearly don't get on well, and quite clearly have for a number of years been having a Sunni-Shia civil war. The fact that Sunni-Shia civil war is happening over a number of different countries through the Middle East is just the fact of the accident of geography and those straight lines been drawn. The two big players, Iran and Saudi, on each side, are controlling it, but they don't therefore have to fight it from a physical perspective on their own physical territories, which is a good thing for them. They're fighting it by proxy on different places, and proxy and influence. And it's that influence and that proxy bit that we're seeing across the board, and we're seeing it back into the Russia-Ukraine conflict at the moment. Remember, Russia's most recent conflict experience is Syria.
That's right.
And the playbook that they had in Syria is the playbook that they're turning to now in Ukraine.
Which is the end state of reduce everything to rubble.
Yeah, yeah. And that's because the Russians have failed in any of their operational level objectives or the strategic objectives as they invaded Ukraine. Putin, I think, expected to have the Ukrainian government toppled within 5 to 7 days, and have a big parade down Kiev, install his puppet government, and go, look at me, I'm building the Soviet Union back again, but it's here, and we brought our little Russians, and remember, he called the Ukrainians little Russians in 2004. We brought our little Russians back under the big brother again, and that hasn't happened, and therefore his next step is to do what he has done elsewhere, and that start reducing everything to rubble. And the steps after that are even more dangerous because it's chemical and potentially nuclear. That's how he's played it out in the Middle East, and it's following almost exactly the same script. And I think from a cyber perspective and everything else, if you look at the scripts between the two, it's virtually the same. There has been some cyber activity with the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Most of it has been relatively unsophisticated DDoS attacks.
And the wiper malware that was several families of different wiper malware was discovered by SentinelOne and Microsoft, but quickly mitigated.
Yeah, exactly. What I was going to say. It's interesting that as the more dangerous malwares that come out on the wiper side, it's not only been identified but mitigated.
Yeah.
So it hasn't actually caused the damage that's there. And the DDoS attacks, have they actually affected anything in reality? Not in particular.
I think it's really telling, because we went from the Georgian conflict, where information was very carefully controlled by the Russians, and now there's no control of the information. Anybody with a cell phone can record a war crime. But I want to zoom into Iran's experience, because as a result of the sanctions against Russia, Russia has kind of turned into the Iran. And Iran right now is sitting back going, hey, we've been there. We know what it's like to have sanctions. We know what it's like to have, you know, our economy in tatters. Do you think this has changed Iran's calculus when it comes to the negotiations over their own nuclear future?
I think it has changed it in a way that I don't think our political leaders have even started to think about at the moment. Because again, go back, Ukraine gave up under a treaty its nuclear weapons along with Belarus
in 2004.
And
for the promise of not being
invaded by the Russians, and the Russians have invaded. You translate that to the Middle East. You know, the international community is trying to force Iran not to go down a nuclear program on a promise that they're not going to be invaded. And Saudi's going, of course we're promising we're not going to invade. Of course, but we're still fighting our proxy war. And therefore, I think the lesson that's going to come out of Ukraine, for in particular the Middle East countries, and in particular when it comes to nuclear proliferation, is we can't trust treaties. And therefore, the only thing we can trust is making sure that we get the bomb and threatening people. And therefore, I think what it's got the potential to do from a geopolitical perspective is accelerate the program, but accelerate the program not just inside Iran,
but across
the region. Now, there's always been the debate as to whether Saudi Arabia's got the bomb or hasn't got the bomb at the moment. Israel, I think we're all fairly certain now, has got the bomb. Iran is going, well, there's a country that's got the bomb, who they're too small to invade us, but actually they've got a very big military and they're our biggest threat that we see. Ooh, we're nervous about this. They're going to redouble their efforts.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of the mythology of nuclear weapons is the fact that, you know, you have to have a massive amount of investment in order to build them. Essentially, you need physicists, smart people, and some fissile material. I mean, this isn't an impossible quest. So we do have a huge problem, especially if, like you said, treaties mean nothing, and that, you know, you put your own country at risk if your neighbors have nuclear weapons. This is the one thing I think that is preventing Putin from eventually attacking countries like Poland and Lithuania, because all of a sudden that will turn into a really ugly shooting war between NATO and Russia.
Yeah, well, I think there's another dimension to this as well. As we increase the sanctions against Putin, Putin's sitting there with an awful lot of valuable potential in warheads and other things that... You know, he is going to need to get foreign currency and other bits and pieces elsewhere. So, you know, I would hope, I'm fairly certain our intelligence agencies are watching it closely, but what's gobsmacked me is how quickly North Korea developed their nuclear weapons and potentially one small enough to go in the warhead of a missile. Mm-hmm. How quickly their missiles developed from failing, you know, 8 times out of 10 short range to being successful 9 times out of 10 long range or intercontinental ballistic in what they're getting out there. And, you know, I find it quite interesting that that happened just about the same time that Russia put a huge internet pipe into North Korea using through the Russian National Railway Company. That just happens to be wholly owned by the Kremlin. And they put internet.
I think they also had some help from Pakistan, and Pakistan made a bit of a deal with the devil there.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting to see, though, from the perspective of China, what does all of this mean, right? Because, you know, China, as you know, it's been on a Belt and Road Initiative to, you know, build its influence. It's, you know, the world's manufacturer, but also the world's greatest theft of intellectual property. Mm-hmm. China playing the long game. What do you think China sees as opportunities? Is this about Taiwan? Is that what's on the table for China?
The Chinese principal desire is economic. No, so anything that they can do to get ahead economically, their come down a level, their political bit, their cultural bit is, you know, the reabsorption of Taiwan into China and all the rest of it. But I think President Xi will have been sitting watching the international community coming together and watching the economic sanctions in particular coming in and suddenly going, that would hurt. You know, those plans that we had for Taiwan in the coming months, let's put them back on the shelf, folks. We can wait, and he can wait. He can wait another 5 years quite easily.
Ten years.
He can wait 10 years because he is in for life. he plans things in a multi-generational perspective, and he was sitting watching very closely the reaction to Putin going in. So what's he going to do now? Well, there's the economic opportunities, and we're seeing this with, you know, the effectively the Western destruction of the Russian economy from all of the business that we're doing.
Right.
So he's going to turn around and go, that gives me all the business opportunities to hoover that up.
I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, there was an article that talked about Russia's potential default on its sovereign debt. What a great opportunity for China to come in and essentially buy that, bail out Russia, and then control them as a proxy.
And look at what China's done in Africa. You know, they've bought ports infrastructure and airport infrastructure and all the rest of it. And whenever countries have come back to them and said, oh, you know that deal that we had, can we renegotiate it and all the rest of it so we own it back again? China's gone, no.
Yeah.
No, it's
yeah.
ours.
Yeah.
China, Xi Jinping's got an opportunity now to expand from an economic perspective and a longer term commercial perspective into Russia and own Russia from that perspective. He's not going to let that pass.
No, it's a great opportunity for the bags of cash that he could lay his hands on, especially in light of some of the decisions that he needs to go more favorably in his direction. So as you and I both know, weapons have proliferated in the Middle East. Development of cyber capabilities. Israel has really shown its ability to conduct a hybrid war since the Intifadas. Mm-hmm. And you know, we've seen where the power of the handheld phone becomes a major factor mm-hmm. in determining sort of the, I would say, the visibility of the activity that is going on in those countries. It's also a very capable targeting mechanism.
Oh, fantastically
right? So. With all of the ability to infect it with malware, but also the geolocation, and if you don't turn off certain features, your latitude and longitude is displayed as you go for your morning run. We've seen the top leadership in Russia get attacked successfully by Ukraine, probably as a result of great intelligence fed to it by, mm-hmm. shall we say, aligned partners.
Who might they be?
Yeah, who might they be? It's those big planes flying around with those disc things on them. But Israel's shown the way in terms of understanding hybrid warfare and understanding that.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when we look at where the Middle East is right now, I feel like we're on the poise of a radical change in Middle Eastern politics,
yeah.
especially from the perspective of investing in Russian equipment and Russian training.
Yes.
It doesn't seem to be working out so well.
Yeah.
Do you want to maybe comment about how that might change the paradigm?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I think Israel, from a hybrid warfare perspective, and properly integrating the cyber sphere, the infosphere into everything they do from a military perspective, are probably the world leaders.
Yeah.
They understand it, but that's because they're throwing the resources at it. They understand that they have to do this from a position of national survival, and everyone in Israel has got this military, this national protection sort of view of everything that they do. So that's driving it, and investment is no object from a government perspective in getting that done. That's why there's some very, very clever people and very clever capabilities coming out that are being exploited elsewhere. So, you know, you get the less than scrupulous Israeli companies selling software that allow you to use your automatic targeting device. And a smartphone is an automatic targeting device.
Mm-hmm.
You know, You carry a smartphone, you carry your smart tablet, you wear a smart watch, and all of a sudden you're broadcasting everything that you're doing to anyone that wants to listen. If people think that turning off the GPS location or turning off something else on it is going to protect you, no.
You remember back in the day taking the batteries out of your BlackBerry, right? Now you can't take, like, the only way to take your battery out is with a hammer.
Yeah. Trying to switch things off is not something that's going to stop you being targeted militarily. But then coming into the kit, you know, a lot of the Russian kit has been sold on the international market, so Russia gets its foreign currency coming in. And everyone has believed that the Russian land equipment, their aircraft and all the rest of it, are of a good standard because the Russians tell us it's of good standard. So it must be.
Yeah.
But I think what we're seeing in Ukraine are relatively inexpensive anti-armor missiles that are developed by the West, anti-aircraft missiles and drones with capabilities on them are... Drones with capability on them are having a huge impact on very, very expensive armored platforms.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of a great way to think about this in terms of what the development of these, I would say, insurgency-friendly capabilities is something that is a harbinger for increasing conflicts. We've seen Hamas make announcements of the hundreds and thousands of rockets that they have available, and that we've seen the defeat of, you know, Israeli armor, which again might be at the top tier of capability. If you're a Middle Eastern country right now, you have geopolitical concerns, obviously,
yeah.
But your cyber concerns are probably starting to become a major risk factor, because what we know of the Middle East is they have a lot of refining and oil pumping capability. We also know that's relatively flammable.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And either a kinetic attack like the drone strikes that the Iranian proxies have been carrying on, but also to malware. And yeah. I think there's been several Shamoon attacks on yeah. Saudi Aramco over the last, you know, 15 years. Do you think there's going to be a Middle Eastern desire to bring in more blue team? And that is start shoring up their national critical infrastructure.
I think it's essential, because you look at the development of a lot of the Middle Eastern cities, Dubai as a classic, it's a smart city.
Yeah.
But in the classical domain. So everything is interconnected. So if everything's interconnected, then the ability to impact it from a military perspective and have a military effect on it by using a cyber weapon is much more so than you attacking a city in the UK. We in the UK, nothing works. So the fact that the train announcement system and the signalling system isn't going to work, is that going to bring the UK to a halt? No.
No.
But you target that into say Qatar with the World Cup going on and the newly developed railway system that they've never had beforehand, and you find that that's linked to their national warning system and linked to security services and linked into government services and all the rest of it. If you can find an endpoint to get in through there, you can close the country down.
I think that's interesting, because we're talking about, you know, the stabilization and closing the country down, because there is one last observation that I want to briefly discuss. Should the Russian-Ukraine conflict go for months? We're now into a situation where we have one of the countries that's responsible, depending on whose numbers you believe, to 30-40% of the world's output of grains and cereal crops coming off the market.
Yeah.
There is capacity within the United States and Canada, but that capacity is somewhat limited. And as a result of the impacts of global climate change, somewhat questionable whether or not there's going to be a bountiful harvest or not. That will have a huge repercussion on the Middle East, where the quality of life and the ability to grow your own food is tremendously limited.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we could see a major destabilization of authoritarian regimes in the Middle East as a result of, you know, I hate to say it, potential starvation down the road.
Yeah. Well, the one thing that I'm sad not to see coming out of some of the bigger commentators and coming out of some of the government think tanks and all the rest is that ripple effect. And the ripple effect of what's happening in Ukraine. And I think it will go on for months, if not longer, because the only way that this is going to stop in the short term is if there's a palace coup in Moscow. And I don't think that those that are surrounding Putin, even several layers underneath, are anywhere near that. I think they're consolidating more behind him in what he's doing. And there is elements of the Russian community are becoming more polarized in support. So we're in a very, very dangerous position here. And I think that will affect food. That will have a ripple effect elsewhere. If Putin starts to carry out false flag attacks of potential radiological release from Chernobyl or elsewhere, that's going to have a global impact on things. If he goes to the next level of the playbook that is used in Syria, the next level is potentially chemical weapons being used. Now, I don't think he's going to do that, because he could blame Assad for chemical weapons in Syria.
That's right.
He can't blame anyone else for chemical weapons in Ukraine. But he can blame a nuclear accident quite easily on Ukraine, especially around Chernobyl, with everything that's gone on there and the destabilization. So he's got tools to play with. And then from a wider economic perspective and geopolitical perspective, you know, we've seen a cementing of the EU when it was starting to fracture, and I never expected that to happen. That will have a huge impact on what's going on. We've also seen a lot of EU countries turning around and going, our defence budgets are woefully inadequate, we're going to have to start spending more on that. Well, that will start a degree of an arms race where we've got friction points elsewhere in the world, China, Taiwan, North Korea, Iran, etc. So we'll see a potential global arms race starting to come into that sort of thing. That will have an impact on the money that a lot of the poorer countries have got then to spend in their economies, and they're not going to put that investment into crops, into the water infrastructure, into the other sorts of things that will then impact onto potentially more movement of people to try and get out of your drought situations and famine situations and elsewhere. The ripple effect of what's going on in Ukraine across the globe is potentially horrific, and that will go on for a very, very large number of years, generations.
I want to thank Philip Ingram, MBE, for coming out and discussing these really hard and difficult topics. Appreciate your time, Philip.
Thank you.